This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars, because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drumroll please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. And today we are honored to have Professor Philip Kitcher with us. Professor Philip Kitcher is a British philosopher who is John Dewey Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Columbia University. He specializes in the philosophy of science, the philosophy of biology, mathematics, literature, and more recently, pragmatism. And today he's here to talk with us about a great book called What's the Use of Philosophy, published by Oxford University Press in 2022. Philip, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Actually, the book has two titles. It has the title that you gave it, which is What's the Use of Philosophy? And it also has another title, What's the Use of Philosophy?
I guess in the version that I have, like, use philosophy is written in red, so that's how I guess you should be pronouncing it. Yeah,
it's designed to call attention to the fact that most people who ask that question ask it dismissively.
You're absolutely right. I had ordered this History of Philosophy by Anthony Kenny, the four volumes, and my manager said, well, what's the use of philosophy? Science has done more for us. I honestly didn't know how to respond, because it was a dismissive question. I didn't engage in any conversation. But I guess this is a very timely question, especially after COVID-19, where there has been a lot of discussions about the use of philosophy or science, or if we should defund humanities or philosophy departments and just put more money into science because it has more use. But these are the questions we'll be talking about. Before we start, can you please just very briefly introduce yourself and tell us how the idea of this book came about?
So I'm Philip Kitcher. I studied mathematics when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge and drifted sideways into studying the philosophy of science, and then got a PhD from Princeton and met my wife there. And I've been very lucky to teach together at the same university ever since. That was a very long time ago. And my interests keep evolving. So I started out being very interested in philosophy of mathematics, got interested in philosophy of biology, general questions about science. Then I got invited by the Library of Congress to write a report for them about the Human Genome Project. That was in the 1990s. That got me interested in issues about science within society, which inevitably brought me into ethical questions and questions of political philosophy, and on and on and on. Then I discovered pragmatism, got very interested in educational issues, and recently I've been worrying about this profession to which I've devoted well over 50 years at this stage, and I've been worrying about its status. So this is a question that's been occupying me, I would say, for 20 years now, and it sort of erupted in an article that I wrote about 10, 12 years ago called Philosophy Inside Out. And that was then sort of quite a lot of discussion took place about it, and that led me to write some further things and eventually to try to put it all together in a book to answer the title question in both senses. I want to address the person who thinks philosophy is useless. I also want to address the more sympathetic person who wants to know what exactly it is philosophy does for us. Mm-hmm. So the book is both a critical one and a positive one. It tries seriously to answer the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does, when I read the question, I read the book, it does feel that way. You're both critical, but you're also trying to engage in a constructive discussion with especially young researchers, which we'll talk about. That's the title of the last chapter, Letter to Some Young Philosophers. But let's talk about the first chapter, Philosophy Inside Out. As you mentioned, this was the title of an article, but you start this chapter with a story, with a tale of musicians. Can you tell us that analogy and then, so, what are you trying to highlight?
So I think philosophers often, when they actually introduce a problem, do well to start with a story. And my story is about a community. It's the community of musicians. And of course, as you know, as I think everybody really knows, even if they don't play a musical instrument, musicians, when they're in training, have to acquire technique. And so think of a violinist or a pianist or a trumpet player or a drum player. What they've got to learn is how to do things with the instrument. And there are all of these famous exercises that people have to go through and to develop their technique. Anyway, this community in my story decides that it's had enough of the classical music pieces or the major music pieces in the genre that it's dealing with. What it's going to do is hold competitions for musicians to show off their technique. And these completely take over what the musical community does. And as I tell the story, the community becomes more and more removed from any outside audience and ends up just playing music, making music for itself. And I use that as a parallel to the situation of philosophy in the 20th, especially late 20th and 21st centuries, where it seems to me that the technicians have taken over and we've lost sight of what philosophy is for.
And that's the state of the Anglophone philosophy that you describe in...
Yeah, I describe English language philosophy, which seems to me most obviously guilty of this. I think I shouldn't comment on other forms of philosophy, although I do have some sort of interactions with and experience of the German tradition in critical theory, is deeply political and seems to me to be very far away from the criticisms that I launched towards Anglophone philosophy. And I should also say that in the time since I wrote that article, there has been a movement towards reinstating questions that are more sort of reaching out to broader audiences. So the article was written probably around 2007, 2008, published around 2010 or 2011. And I don't know how much influence it had. It would be stupid to try to claim that, I started a trend. But it certainly seems to me to be true that these days people are doing more of the sort of thing that the article commended. So the article commended a number of movements within philosophy, particularly attention to issues of class and race and gender. And I do think that the philosophical studies of race have grown by leaps and bounds in the last 30 years. I mean, what philosophers have said has been very useful and very valuable. And I like to think that that trickled down into the consciousness, or perhaps up into the consciousness of Barack Obama when he gave his sort of famous speech on race, because I thought it was actually pitch perfect. I think he had it exactly right, to go on with the musical analogy.
And in this chapter, you talk about core philosophy and applied philosophy. Can you define what you mean by by these two technologies, and give us an example.
Many people who defend technical philosophy as is would identify particular areas of philosophy: metaphysics, philosophy of mind, philosophy of language, perhaps the theory of knowledge, perhaps meta-ethics. And they would say these are the really core areas, and this is the important stuff. And then there are these people who, frankly, aren't good enough to do core philosophy, which is very hard, who go off and slum it, and they write about things like race and gender and, politics and abortion and things like that. And, you know, we don't, it's very worthy stuff, they might say. I'm deliberately putting on my sort of patronizing voice. Very worthy stuff, but, you know, it isn't core philosophy. And that's what we do. And we push back on something that's more important, more intellectually significant. And that idea that there is this core is something that comes up in many, many conversations about the role of philosophy and the state of contemporary philosophy. And so I borrowed it. Although at the end of the book, I actually want to get rid of the idea of a core. I don't want to say that there is sort of one particular part of philosophy that's prior to others. I want to say there are a number of very important philosophical ventures, and none of them corresponds exactly to what the technically minded philosophers think of as the wonderful four areas on which they spend their time.
What you said about philosophy reminded me of what's going on in English departments as well, because we have also cultural studies coming out of English departments, and there are those people who are defenders of literature and that tradition, that philological tradition of reading the text, which is proper literature, let's say, and then they have those who study cultural studies, which is more applied, like the idea of race or gender in movies or music. There are literature professors who are kind of dismissive of that cultural studies because they believe it took a lot of energy out of the English department. So that distinction sort of reminded me of that as well.
I don't know whether that applies directly. I mean, I would be reluctant to say that, but I do think that there are some very interesting people writing about literature today who have connected literary works with contemporary problems and continue to combine them. But there is also, I think, a great tradition, not only the great philological tradition, also the great interpretive tradition, which makes works come alive for audiences. And I mean, I think of, I've learned an enormous amount to just give you a couple of examples. I mean, I think I have a friend and colleague who's a Shakespearean scholar, whom I mention actually in my second chapter, who it seems to me has done remarkable work on making Shakespeare and Shakespeare's relevance intelligible. That's one kind of work. There's another kind of work, again, about Shakespeare by a wonderful and very philosophical Oxford thinker who died some years ago, A.D. Nuttall, called Shakespeare the Thinker. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. And it gets inside the mind of a great poet and starts to help us understand things that we would not see. And there are philosophers. There are great philosophers who have written about literary works. I think of Stanley Cavell, who wrote a wonderful essay on King Lear, and Martha Nussbaum, who has done, I think, some superb work on philosophical themes in literature. And that's one of the things I like to do from time to time, too.
Yeah. What I mean is that there is this debate, and some people are quite dismissive of critical theory and, let's say, French theory in bringing it into literature, but some say no. It's actually a way, as you mentioned, and you mentioned a lot of, and I was also reminded of Simon Critchley, who loves literature, who brings a lot of examples from literature into philosophy, who are able to bring these works into contemporary times, bring it into our contemporary audience and get engaged with problems of today. A question I have about that sort of distinction between applied and core philosophy, which one, I know it might be a kind of a cheesy question, but anyhow, which one do you think is better equipped to deal with the issues of today? We have the rise of populism, we have gender issues or discussions on television every day. So which one do you think is better equipped?
Well, I don't think this is a question that has an answer, because first of all, I'm not, as I mentioned before, I'm not a fan of the idea of philosophy having a core. I mean, there are works of philosophy that deal with more abstract and general issues, but those abstract and general issues are often linked by philosophers to very specific questions about the world in their own times. I mean, I think, for example, of Immanuel Kant. I mean, when you look at the Critique of Pure Reason, it's an amazingly rich theoretical system, and you think, what really does this have to do with, the problems that people face? And the answer is quite a lot. And that was recognized, the immense excitement when Kant's books were published in Germany. They were regarded in some circles as being subversive, and the students had to sort of, go underground to get them, as it were. And Kant himself wrote a number of very powerful articles deriving ideas that were relevant to the controversies and situations of the time from his system. So I'm not against system in philosophy, but it must be system that, as it were, has a purpose, has a connection with something broader than itself. What I'm against is technique for the sake of technique, which is what my little story about the musicians is supposed to highlight.
Let's go to chapter two. The title of the chapter is, So Who's Your Audience? And you talk about three types of audience in that chapter: philosophers, scientists, and the public. So can you tell us why is philosophy of science important, and then discuss these three types of audience as well?
Yeah, so I think that the philosophy of science, which is a part of philosophy to which I have devoted decades of my life and still do. I mean, I still write about issues in philosophy of science, although my take on these days is very different from what it was when I was younger. But philosophers of science have potentially three audiences. They could help philosophers see the philosophical import of different bits of science, or they could venture in to science and try to help scientists sort through difficulties and confusions in contemporary science, or they could do something completely different. They could try to understand science and its role in society and the contributions it makes, and make that apparent for the general public. And I think philosophers of science have sometimes done excellent work in all of these veins. I think the philosophers of science have sometimes shown philosophers how ideas that had permeated philosophy were crude and uninformed, and they've used bits of science to try to suggest a better way of thinking about very general and abstract issues. I think they've done a lot, especially in recent years, to help the sciences sort through some of the difficulties and controversies. So while when I was young, I like many other people, I was part of a movement, philosophical movement, spent a fair bit of time in trying to work my way through the implications of bits of biology for our thinking about human beings and their behavior. This was in the context of the sociobiology controversy of the 1970s and 1980s, where people were saying, well, biology shows us that we are by nature this way, and however much you want things to be otherwise, they can't be otherwise. And I spent a lot of time writing about that, and I think my work made some impact. Other philosophers have sorted through the debates about IQ and what exactly IQ measures, and what we should think about IQ and how we should think about IQ. And others have sorted through sort of very deep scientific controversies about the ways in which, for example, general relativity and special relativity and quantum mechanics all fit together. And, others have done work on the ways in which various parts of biology have controversies that they face. And, I mean, these are, I think, physics, biology, and psychology, and to some extent economics these days, are the main fields that philosophers of science have helped in this way. And I think this has been very profitable work. And then I think philosophers have done some very good things to try to give the general public an account of the workings of science and the ways in which it fits into society. The latter has been especially my concern since I wrote the report for the Genome Project, because that brought home to me the ways in which the social interactions between science and science policy and the broader values of a nation or human beings go forward. So recently, for example, I co-authored with a wonderful colleague, Evelyn Fox Keller, a book about the implications of climate change. And that was a kind of writing about science and how it fits into human life. So, I mean, I think these are all three important ventures. And as I say in the book, I think philosophy of science, like the philosophy of art, actually, and the philosophy of literature, those fields, they sort of grapple with material, and they are much more related, tend to be much more related to questions that are of broad interest to people.
And, you mentioned, I didn't know that you had a book with Professor Keller. I personally owe a lot to her. When I was doing my PhD, I read a lot about the philosophy of science from a feminist perspective.
Because
I was doing some work on ecofeminism back then. I'll definitely check out the book, and I'm more intrigued to know more about that book. In this book, I think it's in its second chapter, around pages 28, you kind of give an overview of the history of philosophy of science. Can you briefly take us through that section of the book?
I'll do it very briefly. I mean, philosophy of science sort of grew out of a movement in the early 1920s. Basically, the logical positivists thought that the task of philosophy, period, was to give an organized account of how the sciences actually had been developed and what they said. It was a tidying up, hygienic exercise to show that, how physics, they were primarily interested in physics, and other sciences all fitted together. Many of them were very well trained in physics and mathematics, and they concentrated their efforts there. All of that started to change when philosophers started to think more broadly about the sciences, both by thinking about more sciences, in particular thinking about biology, and by thinking about the history of science. And there were this great movement in the 1950s and 1960s with people turning to the history of science as a laboratory for trying to understand the sciences. And that was most famously done by Thomas Kuhn in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which has been an enormous inspiration for me. It's what actually got me into philosophy of science and into philosophy. That was combined with a much more sort of detailed engagement with particular sciences in the 1970s and 1980s. And that has now been joined by an understanding of the way in which science fits within various aspects of society, the role of science in democracy, the ways in which science has been shaped by prejudices of society, and the way in which science can contribute to debates about policy matters. I mean, all of that has been pursued much more carefully and much in some very helpful ways in the last 20 to 30 years. I'm delighted to see this trend, and I hope more philosophers will engage in it. That's taking out, taking science and trying to understand aspects of science as they relate to people's lives and to the structures of society.
And there is this sentence on page 53, and I would appreciate it if you could expand on that. You mentioned that we need a much more ethically and politically informed philosophy of science. Well, what do you mean by more ethically and politically informed?
Well, I think there's been this tendency to say, look, you know, when the scientist goes into the lab in the morning, something important changes, because once the scientist is inside the lab, the priorities are very different. You know, it's all about finding the truth and nothing else matters. And I, like other people, I've wanted to break down that wall. I've wanted to see science as an enterprise within a broader human project, and the science as an agent who contributes to human well-being. I don't think of the scientist as, you know, somebody who subverts people's lives or as a secular priest. I think of the scientist as somebody who does work that, in principle, could advance the quality of human lives. And when you see it that way, you see the scientist as an ethical agent. And this idea of, you know, I go into the lab and I no longer have to worry about sort of the ethical issues of the day or what my research means or how it does anything for people at all. Not all that is relevant is pure truth, and I worship that. I mean, it's a crazy idea, because right at the very beginning, you have to realize that the search for truth is not a search for all the truths. It's a search for very particular kinds of truth. And the questions you pose are the questions you think are important. And the questions that are important are the questions which, if answered, will do things that are of genuine value, not just for you to satisfy your own curiosity, but for everybody. And I think the greatest scientists have seen that way. I mean, I just think of the ways in which the physicists reacted, for example, to the uses of quantum theory and to build weapons of great power. I mean, this should not be an alien thing. So that sentence, the sentence has a lot behind it, and I understand why you wanted me to unpack it, but I'm actually writing about this in some detail in some of my current work.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
And I guess you just highlighted why it's important for every scientist to know both the history and also the philosophy of science.
I don't know to what extent that's true. I think what would be good is if people had a broader general education in science. If we weren't so insistent on teaching everybody to be a specialist, as if, you know, every child who comes into physics class, you know, would end up as a researcher in physics. That's a sort of unrealistic goal. I mean, there come moments in which some children, I think of themselves as, you know, not cut out to do science. But they do need a kind of scientific understanding. And that scientific understanding involves a form of literacy about the sciences. It involves maintaining the enthusiasm that most kids have for science. Little kids just love science. They love finding out about the natural world. And it involves understanding something about scientific processes. So it does involve something, knowing something about history and the science and philosophy of science, but many other things besides. And I think what we should be thinking about is how to develop specialists who can advance science beyond the frontiers. But for those who are not going to be specialists, I think we need to think about making them concerned with the scientific issues of the day throughout their lives and really understanding how to absorb scientific information. And that's a different kind of skill than giving them long lists of amino acids to memorize or teaching them how to solve sort of toy problems about artificial sort of physical systems. I mean, we kill their interest by forcing them to do that year after year. And I would like to see us change that. Recognize that there are a number of different constituencies whom we are trying to teach.
Let me follow up that with another question. So in the past 3 or 4 years with COVID-19, there has been a lot of talk about science, the use of philosophy. We've seen a rise of conspiracy theories movements such as anti-vaxxers. So how do you think philosophy of science can benefit science itself?
Well, I actually think it already has. I mean, I think philosophers of science have done a fair bit to try to analyze the ways in which these debates have been generated. They've dissected some of the sort of highly skeptical attitudes. I mean, like other people, I spent a fair bit of time, actually this was in the 1980s, on trying to sort of show as clearly as possible what was wrong with creation science. And that sort of work seems to me extremely important, and philosophers have done a lot of it. They've started to do it with respect to the issues that arose in the pandemic. And I think this is very helpful. I mean, I think it would help even more if some of the people who do this work were able to formulate their ideas clearly and accessibly enough so that they could be widely appreciated. If there were, I mean, I don't know of an article that exposes where the anti-vaxxer movement came from. But scholars, historians, and philosophers of science have done fabulous work on this. And I would love to see that sort of widely appreciated and understood.
And you talk about six maladies, and I love the way you had kind of sorted them out. Six maladies that you identified with philosophy: commitment to clarity, excessive formalism, intuition, a priori, ideas from other fields, and outdated questions. Now, I don't know if we have time or to talk about all.
Let me just say a little something.
Yeah.
That chapter emerged because I really felt that after the first two chapters, I had to give something much more precise, a diagnosis, not just simply point to pathologies within philosophy, but to say what made them pathological. So what do I think has gone wrong with the technical sort of concentration, the professionalization of philosophy? Well, you start off with one very important virtue. We want to be absolutely clear about things. Clarity is a wonderful philosophical virtue, but that goes into a sort of hypertrophic mode. It's like sort of it's like somebody's finger that grows enormously long, right? And why does it do that? Because philosophers have sort of started to think that clarity has to give you a criterion for us answering any possible situation. And that strikes me as a myth. What we need to be able to do is to be clear enough in our concepts to handle the situations that matter to us, not to deal with abstract possibilities that never occur in real life. And much philosophy if you start reading professional articles about incredibly fanciful examples. You know, would this count as knowledge or democracy or justice or whatever, if it were to occur? So in doing that, they recognize that sometimes using a formal mathematical style language may be very helpful, but they drive this to extremes and try to make everything formalized. And when they're dealing with these cases, which they're trying to clarify, they make up artificial examples and then say, our intuition about this example is such and such. So everybody who reads about philosophy knows about the trolley problem, right? You've got a runaway trolley. It's heading down the track. There's a guy on the track strapped to it. You have the possibility of diverting the trolley so that it goes on. There are five people on the track. You have the possibility of diverting it so it goes onto a track, but there's one person bound on that track. So there you are. What's your intuition about this? Well, I've tried this out on classes of students, and they always shift uneasily, except for those who have advanced views about what philosophical system they want. So the students who are sort of naive and thinking just don't know what to say. And they don't know what to say because the example is too remote from the kinds of choices they're used to making. It's not good for the kinds of cognitive apparatus we've evolved biologically and socially to have. The world is too small and too simplified. I mean, my students tell me again and again, I know, I mean, what would I do if I were in that situation? Well, I'd look around for some other way to get out of the problem, to save everybody. And that's of course a very, natural response. And the philosopher says, no, you know for certain that that's impossible. But how can I know for certain that that's impossible? I mean, what would tell me that? So there's a kind of craziness that goes on here, I think. This is not to say that philosophy can't use telling examples. I think it often does. But they have to be meshed with the life that we live, not sort of abstracted away. So philosophers claim to be able to know things a priori on the basis of this kind of intuition. That seems to be a myth. They also claim sometimes just that certain kinds of principles are beyond questioning, which seems to be dogmatism by another name. But some philosophers get inspired by this to go off and try to call on the findings of other disciplines. And some people do this very well. They know a lot of physics, they know a lot of mathematics, they know a lot of economics, they know a lot of something or other. They know a lot about art. But all too often, the other discipline isn't taken seriously enough. So they stop learning too soon. And then finally, some philosophers content themselves with the idea that, there are these old questions, these timeless questions that permeate philosophy, and we have to keep answering them. I think there's something to that, but I think the trouble is they arise in new forms in different times, and you have to pay attention to the kind of questions that are urgent for the times. When I was thinking about this book, I read a marvelous philosophical discussion with a philosopher whom I'd never read before, who was writing about the difficulties, the philosophical questions that arise when people who have come from relatively humble origins get the opportunity to rise into a different social sphere. So what she was concerned about was the ways, the questions of how ethically to negotiate this kind of difference between the world in which somebody comes to live and the world in which they started. It's a wonderful question. And it was handled extremely with great sensitivity in the book. That was an example of somebody seeing how to pose a genuine and deep ethical question that arises in a different social context. Because it's all over the place. There are people who are, first generation to go to college or first generation to go into a particular very sort of exciting and interesting and rewarding area. And the question is how they think about themselves in relation to where they come from. I mean, this is meaningful for me since I came from humble origins. Nobody in my family had been to university. My parents left school at 12 and 14. I mean, all of this is, this is a phenomenon that is possible today. And here was a philosopher coming along and saying, so there is a kind of ethical question that arises for us that hasn't arisen before.
It's a fascinating example. I'm keen to know the name of the author and the article because it sort of applies to me as well. And yeah, I'll ask.
It's in the book. It's in the book. It's in the last chapter of the book, I think. I think it's in the last chapter of the book, yeah.
The last chapter of the book is called Letter to Some Young Philosophers. It's a very, very interesting chapter. It's more like a dialogue sometimes. Can you talk about that one and then also tell us the young philosophers?
Let me just say before we get to that, what goes on in the chapter before, because the fourth chapter, the one that follows the pathology, is really an attempt to say what philosophy can do for everybody, which is to sort out our confusions, help us make sense of ourselves and the world in which we live. And that, I think, is what draws many people into philosophy. They want to engage in that kind of enterprise. They want to try to understand how to put together the various aspects of lives. They want to form a kind of synthetic understanding of the world in which they live and their place in it. Now, when I have given talks on these themes, it's been very interesting because over a period of 10 to 12 years, I have sometimes talked about this material. And philosophical discussions are notoriously cutthroat, but very often what's happened is that I've heard from my audiences an enormous amount of sympathy for what I'm saying. You know, people have raised their questions and said, so I'm really sympathetic to what you said. This is, you've said why you've told me why I went into philosophy, reminded me of that. But it's so far from the professional discipline in which I am being trained, have recently been trained, am now struggling to survive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So my last chapter is called Letter to Some Young Philosophers, and it's an attempt to write to them about the problem they raise again and again. How do I handle the demands of professionalization and at the same time honor the motives that drove me to philosophy in the first place? It seems that there are the questions that really matter to me, the questions I wanted to address, are not being addressed by the people who have highest standing in my profession. So professionalism is dragging me one way, and my intellectual interests, in some cases, my very strong intellectual interests are pulling me in another. And I explicitly riffed on a title from Rilke. Rilke wrote Letters to a Young Poet. Well, I make the philosophers plural and, So I try to sort of answer these questions because I think it's a very, very important sentiment that they are actually voicing. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had a really satisfactory answer to it. I propose a number of ways of trying to integrate these things. I point to some models for integrating, but I don't think I've said anything like the last word. But I hope that the trend that I have seen happening of philosophers becoming more outward-looking in breaking down the barriers that cut off philosophy departments the last 40 years, really, from many other disciplines. Philosophy, the humanities are held in low regard, and philosophy is completely cut off from its sort of fellow humanities. philosophers have got a reputation for not being able to talk to anybody. That's not true. I mean, there are many philosophers in the world today who can talk to other people. You mentioned Simon Critchley, for example, but there are many, many others. I mean, there are one of the most influential philosophers, if not the most influential English language philosopher in the world today, is Martha Nussbaum, who has an enormous audience and has, I think, written works that have, really illuminated the thinking and the lives of many, many people. So it's not impossible to do this. It's just been professionally undervalued for a very long time. And that's a bad thing. The young philosophers realize this, and they want to know how to balance the demands that are issued to them by the profession with their wish to do this kind of thing. So that's what the last chapter is all about.
And as you mentioned, these are difficult questions, and there might not be a final answer to that. But I have another question as well. More recent, I mean, in general, but especially more recently after COVID-19, there has been this push by a lot of policymakers and politicians to encourage more students to study science because it's productive. It contributes something to the economy, and unfortunately it has come at the cost of defunding humanities. I live in Australia. This is happening in Australia and also in the United States, England, many parts of the world. Do you think this is doing any service to science?
No, I think it's bad all around. It seems to me that the pressure to push young people into so-called STEM subjects arises not from a consideration of their individual propensities. We're not thinking about sort of drawing out what will satisfy, what will enrich the life of an individual. We're thinking about students as cogs in a machine to serve the productive purposes of the nation. I mean, in part, I think this comes from a completely screwed up economic system, which has, largely abandoned the idea of public goods, that has seen everything in terms of competitive interactions, has seen markets as just things that produce consumer goods at the cheapest possible price. So in my book, The Main Enterprise of the World, Rethinking Education, I propose to look at it the other way around, to think about the education of the student first, and to think about the economic arrangements as to be designed, as it were, to accommodate what a good education and good development in human life would turn out to be. Now, why don't I think it's good for science? Because I think it turns off young people who might take a passionate interest in science at some later stage of their life, who are forced to study particular sciences, compete in a particular way at a particular stage of their lives. I think it doesn't teach them what they need to support science, which is that kind of scientific literacy I was mentioning earlier. It fuels attitudes of alienation towards science, which lead to these skeptical movements. And it doesn't respect the kinds of creativity and the kinds of contributions that the humanities make. So sometimes when I'm giving talks about the sciences and the arts, after I try to show that, in fact, the arts too contribute to human well-being, I ask the audience, so think about your own life and think about the ways in which you've developed. Which has been more important to you, the things that you've gotten out of your interactions with arts and literature and history, or the things you've gotten out of your interactions with the natural sciences? Think about the person you are and how you've become that person. Think about your self-understanding. Think about the ways in which your life has been shaped. And what I get is typically a fairly substantial majority who will say, actually, it's the arts and humanities that have helped me see who I wanted to be and have helped me make my life the way it is. And the exceptions tend to be people who are studying science, who are already committed to the sciences. I think what we've failed to appreciate is the fact that the important thing here is to nourish intellectual and emotional life and creativity. And nourishing that is not achieved by trying to force people into a mold that for many of them produces resentment and alienation. So I think it's bad all around. But the argument for this takes me about 400 pages.
Yeah. Well, I actually did not know about this book. It's a good book to follow up with for me and also our listeners. The Main Enterprise of the World, Rethinking Education, which was published in 2021 by Oxford.
That's right.
Yeah. Professor Philip Kitcher, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Fascinating ideas you talked about. And I encourage our listeners to check the book, The Philosophy of Science. It's a very short and easy book to read. And it poses a lot of questions. And it gives us a lot to think about and engage with.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed the interview. I enjoyed your questions. And I hope I provided something towards answering some of them.
You certainly have.